Good morning, and thanks for tuning in to 88.5 KRFY and our current affairs program, Community Conversations. I'm today's host, Chris Bessler. The Idaho Legislature convened its annual session in January and is now about two-thirds of the way through completion. Today we talk with two of our three District 1 legislators about bills and possible new laws that are of interest or importance to North Idaho. We speak with Senator Jim Woodward and then talk with Representative Sage Dixon. Our third local legislator, Representative Heather Scott, did not respond to our emailed invitations to take part. Among the topics we discuss are transportation funding, taxes, the bill to increase requirements for citizen initiatives, and even a bill on reindeer. We'll turn to our conversations in just a moment, but first a few words about this program. We air community conversations every Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. with recorded interviews on local issues. There's a podcast of each show available later on those days after airtime on our website at krfy.org. These shows are recorded a few days prior to airtime, and this show was recorded on Monday and Tuesday. So some of the legislation you'll be hearing us discuss may have moved forward or conversely failed to move forward in committee or floor votes. For the latest on all legislation, the state maintains an excellent website with the current status on the web at legislature.idaho.gov. And with that, let's get on with today's interviews. First with Senator Jim Woodward for about 20 minutes, and following that with Representative Sage Dixon for about the same amount of time. We're talking now with District 1 State Senator Jim Woodward. Jim, thanks so much for breaking out time from your schedule down there.
Well, you bet, Chris. Happy to anytime.
So I think this is your third year in the legislature. Correct me if I'm wrong there. How would you generally characterize this legislative session compared to previous years?
Well, you're right. This is my third year, and it is different, both for me because the experience I've gained in the past and, of course, just different situation with the pandemic we've had in the last year. And I think a lot of built up frustration from folks, and we hear and see that. And so we're trying to keep that in perspective that we're in a different setting, and hopefully we'll roll on past this and think back on this pandemic as just 1 year in our lives. And so that's something I try to keep in perspective as we're voting yes or no on different proposed law. Don't want to put something in place now that doesn't work in the future because it's really written in reaction to situation this year. So just trying to make sure we're writing long-term policy when we write a law.
Well, observing the legislative session from up here in the far north, it seems like at least early on in the session, there was a lot of movement by individual legislators to basically curtail the emergency powers of the governor, as specifically as relates to the pandemic. But of course, it would apply to any emergencies that might come up in the future, I'm sure. What's the status of some of that legislation?
I think that some of that early on, the thought process where maybe it was a little bit reactionary, we've gotten past that. Things have toned down a little bit, but we are still looking at those sections of code surrounding the health districts. Our health district, of course, is Panhandle Health District, but there are five or seven districts around the state. And then also rules around schools, and been some other discussion about quarantine and isolation and really defining those. And there's some great valid conversations to have. One, the quarantine. And typically in the past, when someone is sick, then the health district might have them quarantine, that person who is sick quarantine. And that was different than what happened this year, where we were all asked to, in some way, isolate ourselves. So good conversations to have. We just want to make sure that we're maintaining the right perspective, that not just working from a sense of frustration.
Is there some of that legislation that's likely to be passed in terms of
the relative power between the two branches of government. We have the executive branch, that's the governor, and the legislative branch.
I think some of those pieces are, I can't think of any that are really moving through right now. The one though being the ability of the legislature to call itself back into session. So that's been a big question. What should the legislature be able to do? But a question before that is, should the legislature be calling itself back into session? What would the role of the legislature be? I try to keep in mind that the legislature is a policy setting body. The executive branch is day-to-day action. And so if the policy is in place and is appropriate, do we need to be in session to change policy unless we're responding to something? And I think that's just good to keep in mind that even though there were a lot of frustrations this year, maybe we something that's worked well for 130 years in the history of Idaho, let's not be too quick to change what was going on there. A couple pieces that I see moving right now in regards to the health district and the role of the health district and county commissioners. And the proposal is that for a county-wide health restriction to be put in place or a health district-wide, all five of the counties in our health district, if a restriction were put in place, then the county commissioners would have to vote on that afterward to approve it or not. And so the elected official would have the final say, because some of the members of the health district board are not elected officials, and they've been appointed by the commissioners. So the health district board can be commissioners plus a doctor as a technical expert, but sometimes we see that the health district board is composed more of people appointed by to fill in for the commissioners. So that's one. And then the other is who should be able to shut down a school. And that piece of legislation is moving through right now. A similar idea that the school board would have the final say, working in conjunction with the health district.
Are those bills likely to pass?
I believe those two are. They are. And they're out of the Senate, I think, now, and head over to the House. And then the first one I talked about, the ability of the legislature to call itself back into session has passed out of the Senate also, but that is a constitutional amendment, and so that will go through the House and Senate and the governor, and then will have to be on the ballot in 2022 for approval by the public.
I see. But does the governor have an opportunity to veto that if he wants, and which would then entail a two-thirds majority to pass it?
Actually, I need to think back on it, because that's not a Senate bill or a House bill. It's a resolution. And so, no, the resolution puts the constitutional amendment on the ballot.
I see.
If two-thirds of the Senate and two-thirds of the House both vote on that resolution, then that goes to the ballot. But it still has to be approved by the voters.
So that's something we are likely to see on the ballot in probably be a couple of years, not this next.
Yeah, I think the ballot's going to be full of some big issues. I think you'll see that proposed constitutional amendment about the legislature's ability to call itself back into session. And then we'll also most likely, I think you'll see a proposed constitutional amendment work its way out of the body here on psychoactive drugs, which would be any psychoactive drug from marijuana to mushrooms or hallucinogens. That proposal is to put in the Constitution a prohibition on psychoactive drugs. And I think right alongside those, there will probably be a few initiatives. It's my understanding that there is a signature gathering happening now for both recreational marijuana and medicinal marijuana effort. And so it could be that in 2022, be voting yay or nay on three different pieces about drug use.
Well, that's
shaping up kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there'd be some clear differences between those proposals too on the ballot. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, one issue that's gotten attention up here is Senate Bill 1110, which would increase requirements for citizens to pass an initiative. Currently, 6% of voters in 18 districts, but 6% of the total voters statewide are required to sign a petition to get a proposed law on the ballot. The Senate Bill 1110 would increase that requirement to 6% of voters in all 35 districts. I believe you voted against that one. Can you outline your thoughts on that one, please?
You bet, Chris. So yeah, you're right. 6% in 18 of 35 now, and that's 6% of registered voters. And we have approximately 1 million voters here in the state. So that means collecting 60,000 signatures. And if those 60,000 signatures can come from 18 districts, well, then you can go and focus on the population centers and ignore, or maybe not ignore is not the right word, but not go out into the rural area. And that was the that is the intent of that bill, Bill 1110, to make sure that everybody is on board. And that's, I think that's the intent of the idea behind a petition process is there a broad support to put this on the ballot, or is there enough support to put it on the ballot to make it worthwhile for the cost of putting something on a statewide ballot? And where I probably am or would like to see more than 18 districts, just because right now there are 18 districts within Kootenai County, Ada County, and Canyon County. I think you can get those three, or including Bonneville. So you can go to just four counties and get those 60,000 signatures and also meet the 18 district requirement. So it might be good to have that number up a little bit, but I thought that 35 out of 35 is a pretty high bar when we're just trying to show interest. And the question is still not on the ballot. The question is, are we putting it on the ballot? And when an initiative makes it on the ballot, then the entire population gets a chance to say yay or nay on that.
Yeah, we actually had former Idaho Supreme Court Chief Justice Jim Jones was on KRFY and spoke on this issue a couple weeks ago. And he characterized the bill basically as a disenfranchisement of the power of the citizens to get potential laws directly on the ballot themselves. He questioned if it would even be constitutional to raise the bar that high, because he thinks it would make it almost impossible. And it is a right that's guaranteed in the state constitution.
Yes, I think his thoughts are probably stronger than mine about where, that. And he has certainly studied the law much more than myself, a sailor and a construction worker. But I've read some of his writing and heard some of that.
So I saw it just today that it was passed through the Senate. You opposed it in committee, and then it came up for a vote, and it did pass the Senate, went over to the House, and the House just today has the House committee approved it, so it's going to come up to a full vote in the House. It's kind of looking like that bill is going to pass, because it passed in the committee on a straight party line vote, 12 Republicans voting in favor, 2 Democrats voting against it. That's today. And I should note, we're speaking on Monday. This broadcast isn't going to air until Thursday. So things could change there. It could already have been voted on by the full House by the time this gets to on the air. A couple of years ago, the governor vetoed a similar bill that would also raise that requirement it was quite a bit different in the way it was structured, but bottom line was would make it much more difficult to get a citizen initiative on the ballot. And those groups that favor this sort of power to the citizens say it's already extremely difficult. Raising the number of signatures they have to raise in order to get something on the ballot is something that's achieved, even though initiatives get organized, they don't usually get the number of signatures they need to actually make it on the ballot. And then, of course, the whole state votes on it. I guess the question now would be, since the House is probably headed towards the approval of it, how do you think the governor stands on this? Do you think he's likely to sign this one?
Well, Chris, I think you're right. It comes through the House. And then I don't know the answer on the governor's stance on this. I haven't spoken to any of the staff or to him on Senate Bill 1110.
So would you have to wait and see or ask the governor that question, I guess?
Yes.
but I will say, you know, it's probably passing with a higher threshold than the 2/3 that would be needed to override his veto. So we'll have to hang on to that one. Other bills that are working their way through, is there Idaho, unlike a lot of other states, it has posted a pretty significant budget surplus, over $500 million. Are there some bills shaking out that are likely to channel that money into different things? I'm thinking more specifically of transportation.
You bet, Chris, there are. I do spend a fair portion of my day on the budget every day because I'm on the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee. And we're working through both changes to the current budget year, which is fiscal year 2021 that we're in now, and then also at the same time now setting budgets for fiscal year 2022, which starts on July 1st. So that's halfway through the calendar year 21, the end of the fiscal year 22. And coming in with that more revenue here than anticipated, I like to make sure everyone understands that that money there is not ongoing money, that the money that is accumulated this year was really due to three major factors. A holdback last year, 5% holdback, along with a different Medicaid match rate this year. So we've seen more money. We typically share cost with the federal government, 70% Idaho, 30% federal government on match rate on Medicaid. And this year, it's the other way around, 70% federal and our 30% match. And this year, the federal government is picking up 76% of those costs, Medicaid. And I'm saying, really getting it messed up here, so I apologize. But the match rate for Medicaid is higher. And so that has resulted in about an extra $200 million, along with the $200 million from the holdback. And then the economy has been running strong. So we have that extra money, but that's all money that is here and now in the account, but we won't necessarily see it again in the future. And so we don't want to make any commitments that are ongoing. So that money is being used as one-time money. And the process for that is the supplemental appropriations or add-ons to the 2021 budget. And those are coming out in the form of transportation. We ran a supplemental bill just the other day that's out of the Finance Committee. It should go right through the House and the Senate. That's $122 million for transportation improvements, split between the statewide improvements and the local improvements. And so about $47 million that's coming out to all the counties, cities, and highway districts, which is great. And so our counties will benefit from that, have that extra money in there, and on the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars extra to work with for projects. And then as part of this too, both Representative Dixon and then Senator Carl Crabtree, who's District 7, who represents the Sagal, the east side of the highway. We've been working away at that Lakeshore intersection, and we do have approval for improvements there on the Lakeshore intersection. That Idaho Transportation Department Board met in February and approved that project, and we'll see phase one this summer and phase two next summer, and I'm really excited about that because that's been a real safety issue for us.
So that's Highway 95 or Lakeshore, just at the south end of the Long Bridge, comes into Highway 95, and it's a pretty difficult and kind of hair-raising left turn out of there with the amount of traffic we have now. What kind of improvement would this finance?
The improvement that is improvements there, phase one in this year, which we should, so this coming summer, we should see and benefit from our acceleration lanes northbound and southbound. And so if you're on Lakeshore and you're coming to the intersection where you want to turn onto Highway 95, if you want to turn south, the way I understand it, there will not be a stop sign to turn south. You'll be able to roll through a yield and accelerate and go to the south. And then to the north, adding a middle lane where you can get out and accelerate into traffic in a northbound acceleration lane onto the bridge. And those are the couple of solutions that the transportation department identified that we could quickly get help alleviate some of the problem. Then into phase two for the next year are some turnarounds similar to the north end of town out in Pond Ray, where you can have a divided lane and you can make a U-turn and go the other way. And so where people right now have come up with their own solution to turn to the south and then come up, turn into the parking lot on the other side of the highway and go north, that'll be formalized. It'll be a little bit further down the road, but it'll serve both the Lakeshore intersection and the Bottle Bay intersection, where if you want to go south from Bottle Bay Road, you can go north and turn around, make a U-turn. From Lakeshore, if you need to go north, you can go south and do a U-turn and go to the north. So a couple of great improvements. And then the other part of that project is most likely a traffic light at the Sagal intersection. Back at where Sagal Road comes in and at the gas station there, which some folks probably won't be excited about a traffic light, but it does a lot for safety, and it also puts brakes in traffic. When you have that stop and go, then there are more openings for people to get onto the highway at one of those side roads that are coming.
Okay. Well, believe it or not, we don't have that much time left, but I did want to ask any other transportation-oriented projects that might come out of the, you know, the budget surplus that affects us up here.
Well, what having that extra money to work with in the transportation department moves all the projects up the roster. So where we got this one moved up by going past some of the others. We have other projects, MacArthur Lake, which has been scheduled for 2023, and we'll at least be able to continue that schedule, or maybe we'll even be able to move it up. So we'll keep pushing on that, because that's all safety issue also between Waters and Sandpoint.
And are there any pending bills relating to education funding?
This week, we're going to set the K-12 budget on Friday. Last week, we did the higher education budgets out of JFAC, out of the Finance Committee. We sent those out for the four-year institutions and the community colleges. And then this week, we'll have the K-12 budget, which looking forward to getting that moving down the road.
Are they allocated? Do these budgets allocate more money?
Some small increases, but not some of the big increases that we've seen. K-12, I think for the last 6 years straight, has added $100 million per year to the base of that budget. And I don't think you'll see quite that much this year, but still some improvement.
Okay. While we're on the subject of the budget surplus, the fact that Idaho is doing remarkably well in this pandemic economically, though, as you mentioned, it's due to some kind of special circumstances that won't necessarily be coming around every year. But we are seeing the highest growth rate in the country in terms of our population growth in Idaho, actually number one. It's been that way for two or three years, I believe. It is driving real estate values up. It's become, as you know, in Sandpoint, cost of home ownership has really gone up. That also stands to raise taxes on property owners. Are there any property relief bills that are pending down there?
Yes, yeah, so Senate Bill 1108 or 1108 is on our calendar to vote on, has been for a week. There's some different thoughts about how that might work out. We're going to meet again tomorrow on that. It's scheduled to vote on Wednesday. I don't know if that vote will happen or not, but the idea is that Senate Bill 1108 is a budget cap for taxing district and changes the mechanism that we've had in place for some time now around budget growth, because you have the budget growth does. If you have a bigger budget, then you have to collect more taxes. But the other side of property tax, the problem here is that residential values are increasing so much faster than commercial or agricultural or timber that the residential properties are picking up more of the load, and that's where we need to get into some a better solution how to make property tax work. We have this three-legged stool of income tax and sales tax and property tax. And property tax is far and away the most challenging to work with. It is stable from the perspective of maintaining budgets in when times are, when economic times are tough, but maybe that's not the right answer. You know, income tax and sales tax go down during a recession, and then the state budget is driven primarily by income tax and sales tax, about 90% of the budget. So then the expenditures have to go down. Property taxes don't necessarily go down, or they go down much slower. There are a lot of pieces there. We'd look at just your current year assessed value. We could go to a five-year rolling average on your assessed value, and that would help take out some of these highs and lows. But really, the property tax relief that we're kind of nibbling around the edges is a change to the homeowner's exemption and then the circuit breaker for the lower income. And those are, I hope that they, something ends up happening there, but right now nothing is happening. Senate Bill 11-8 is really focused on the limiting growth of budget. And I characterize that bill as a law always applies across the state, and I characterize that bill as a statewide solution to a three-county problem. The real driver for that bill is Canyon County and Ada County and Kane County. But we, at the standpoint, we are also seeing those increasing assessed values, and then along with that, some of the increasing property taxes.
Well, Senator Jim Woodward, is there any other legislation that you want your constituents to know about in just the couple minutes we have left here?
I think that covers quite a bit of it, Chris. There are a lot of pieces there. If anybody wants to look at legislature.idaho.gov, there's a bill tracker on there. You can see all the legislation, see where it is, whether it's in committee or on one of the floors, and see the voting records. All the information is there. That legislature.idaho.gov is a great website that has a lot of information on it to be able to follow the process. And folks should know, too, that where it's been near impossible to testify in committee from the northern end of the state in the past, but one benefit to this changes this year, they can now sign up and testify in committee via Zoom.
Yeah, that's actually an empowering thing that came out of the pandemic. So I guess, thank you, pandemic, for that little, yes. One little thing. Well, Senator Woodward, I want to say thanks again for taking time to talk with us here today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
We're now speaking with our District 1 State Representative in the Idaho Legislature, Sage Dixon. Sage, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Well, I'm happy to do it, Chris. I'm glad you're giving me this opportunity. I appreciate it.
Well, you're an old hand in the Idaho Legislature now. This is your seventh year serving. How would you generally characterize this legislative session compared to previous years?
It's much busier. There's a lot more activity. Given everything that was going on last year with COVID and the way the legislature felt that we weren't being invited into the discussion on some of the decisions being made, we were all pretty anxious to get going quickly once we got down here. And we did get going pretty quickly, but we also found that a lot of the ideas we had were conflicting with some things, or we weren't approaching the right issues in trying to correct what we thought was that relationship between the executive branch and the legislative branch when it comes to emergency orders. So that's taken a long time, but all the other great ideas that we come down here with are have bubbled up as well, and there's just been a lot of activity, even though there doesn't seem to be as many people in the halls because of the restrictions that are down here in Boise. It's been a very busy year, and we're still running.
And I'm going to guess you still have a ways to go.
Yes. Well, we had some direction this morning in our chairman's meeting. We're looking at March 26th, but the speaker was he said, if I were to say March 7th, then you guys would procrastinate even more. So he's shooting for March 26th. I mean, not March 7th, April 7th. Shooting for March 26th to get most of our business done. We have a date where the afternoon committees can no longer hear new ideas, the RS process, what we call print hearings. And that was on the 15th of February, and then we have, I'm sorry, not the 15th of February, it was 2 weeks ago. And then we have what's called the transmittal date, which was Monday, and theoretically that's when we want all the House bills to be off the floor and sent over to the Senate. But we are still hearing the print hearing for some bills in the House as of today. So we've missed that deadline. And those are just targets to kind of keep things moving, and things always spill over. But those ideas are still coming. And in fact, I have a print hearing tomorrow morning in State Affairs here in the House. So one of my final bills is just going to get going as well.
Mm. Okay. What committees do you sit on now?
I am on revenue and taxation in the morning, and that's the second term that I've served on that committee, which I'm thankful for, because my previous terms I had been moved every term. So this is my second term there on revenue and tax, which just makes it easier to understand the conversation and where the legislation is coming from. Once you spend time on a committee, you start to really get a fuller picture of ideas in the state. And when a new idea comes, you have something to balance it off of. So I'm thankful for that. Then my afternoon committees are transportation and defense, and then business. And the business committee is the committee I'm the chairman of.
Okay. Well, if we have time, we'll dig in on that a little bit more. But I did want to ask, you already mentioned that there was some legislation or some movement to restrain the powers of the governor in emergency declarations, if I'm characterizing that accurately. Can you give us your take on, you know, what some of those various bills, what the status on those are?
Sure. The one I'm most familiar with is House Bill 135 that we passed last week, I believe it was. And that addresses the length of an emergency order. It addresses not restricting businesses under an emergency order, upholding the First Amendment right to assemble, and then religious assembly specifically. And then there also was, there's one other component in there that I can never remember, so I'm sorry, I'll have to look that up. But that deals, so a lot of what we came down here to do was to address, first of all, the right to, or the ability for the legislature to call itself back into session. And that has all taken a lot of discussion, even though we had working groups on these issues and the House and Senate were discussing this before we came down to Boise. The dynamic changed a little bit once everybody got in the building and other voices were heard, and things morphed a little bit. But it was House Bill or House Joint Resolution 3 that was a constitutional amendment. That it might have been actually one, and I apologize that I don't remember specifically right now. But it allowed us to call ourselves back into session with a vote of 60%, at least 60% of the legislature. And then the Senate thought it needed a few more sideboards. They have a Senate joint resolution coming out. They just created a whole new bill rather than amending that. That makes it keeps that 60%, but then it has to be for specific topics. And so it wouldn't be a wide open session that may keep us here longer. So similar to what the governor has the ability to do now, we would have to have that majority of the legislature agree to come back for specific topics. So that passed off the House and the Senate. They're probably going to hear it this week in House State Affairs, and we should be voting on it on the floor probably on Friday. I would say it may spill into next week, but we should be able to vote on that. And then, of course, being a constitutional amendment, it would go to the people to see if they agree that we should have that ability. And that's specifically directed at the emergency orders. But House Bill 135 says the governor has 30 days, and he can extend that by another 30 days. But after that point, it can only be extended with a concurrent resolution of the legislature in doing that. So those are the two main ones that address the emergency order and the emergency declaration. A lot of the other things were to address the mandates and the fear of vaccine mandates, But a lot of those things statutorily weren't under the governor's authority. They were under the health district authority or the Department of Health and Welfare. So that's where a lot of the ideas had to be altered and look at different areas of code and how to get that all taken care of. And it doesn't, there's a few things biting around the edges, but some of those ideas have not gone forward in dealing with the health districts. There was something called the Business Bill of Rights that would not allow businesses to be closed down and other restrictions placed upon them, and the fact that their licenses could not be removed if they chose to remain open. And dealing with things like that, we've had a few attempts to restrict or prevent against a vaccine mandate. I happen to be an ad hoc member of the governor's vaccine advisory committee, and so that's not been part of the discussion at all. Most of the discussion has been fairly mundane about who should get the vaccination first. It was the hierarchy of highest risk and being first responders and hospital staff and such, and then working its way down. So that discussion has not come up at all, but there's still some concern about it. So we did pass a bill, I believe it was House Bill 140, that said businesses doing business with the state cannot require a vaccine. That was about as strong as language we could get at this point coming out of the House. There may be some things working through the Senate that I'm, excuse me, not aware of. But those are all pointing in that direction. A few other things. I actually passed a bill strengthening parental rights because the governor has the ability to suspend executive branch rules under an emergency declaration, and there was some concern that some of the rules he did suspend would have allowed children to be removed from a home under the guise of the emergency order. So I added to our parental rights statute that an emergency declaration or disaster declaration shall not constitute a compelling government interest, that in and of itself. So if we did have another COVID instance and we were having to make those decisions again, that if mom and dad had COVID, that Child Protective Services couldn't come in and take the children under the guise of it being an emergency declaration. So it strengthened that. And I also, within that language, it also prohibits forced medical action. So they couldn't force children to be vaccinated, just to strengthen the parental rights statute that we already had. That is being heard. I made it through the House committee and off the floor, and it'll be heard in the Senate tomorrow, actually. So little things like that we're doing, and a few big things, but I think there's still going to be some discussion once our bills get over to the Senate.
So on those couple broader bills you mentioned in relationship to the governor's powers, for instance, the ability of the legislature to call itself into session, which only the governor can do right now for these special sessions. What's your position on those?
I fully support that, Chris. I think it's important that we, as the elected representatives of the people, are making decisions when it affects the whole state. One thing that I proposed for that legislation, but the committee or the sponsors didn't think it was necessary, but was having two separate tracks or paths when it comes to emergency declarations, because all the previous emergency declarations have all been localized and necessary, be it wildfires or floods or whatnot. And even the large amount of snow we had a few years ago, that was an emergency declaration, and nobody really had an issue with that. But when it was something that was pertaining to the whole state and edicts coming from the governor's office that were restricting people in the whole state, in my opinion, that's when the legislature definitely needs to be involved, because that's what we're elected to do, is to represent our constituents' interests. So having the ability for us to be called back into session, I think, is imperative. And I do support that, and I think I'll support what's coming back over from the Senate. I don't mind those safeguards there. We definitely don't want to be a full-time legislature or even have the ability for that to become one easily in the future when all of us aren't even here. So I think it's wise to have those sideboards, as we call it, on that bill going forward. Mm-hmm. And then I do support House Bill 135 also. And it's important that the executive branch act quickly when it needs to. And those numbers are longer than I supposed he would need, or whomever the governor is would need. But that's what we got in conversations with the Senate, and it seems fine to me to go forward with those 60 days, and then you have to check with the legislature. Mm-hmm. Because that was a lot of the angst that we heard from our constituents throughout the state, and that's what we would like to do. That and churches being shut down, or the seemingly arbitrary decisions on what is essential and what isn't essential, those all played into a lot of the concern of the population last year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's move on to another issue that's gotten some attention up here, Senate Bill 1110, which would increase the requirements for citizens to pass an initiative. Currently, it's 6% of the voters spread out over 18 districts have to sign the petition to get an initiative on the ballot, and this bill would increase it to 6% of voters in each of the 35 districts. And I'm not sure the disposition of that right now. I know it got through the Senate, and I don't know if it's come to the House floor yet.
Not to the floor yet. It did pass out of committee earlier this week, and it could be on the floor as early as Friday. It did not get read across the desk today, which is the first step, and then it'll go on the second reading calendar. So I imagine either tomorrow or Thursday it'll be on the second reading calendar, and it could be heard as early as Friday or Monday, I would say, at the latest.
Are you hearing from constituents on this bill?
Not much.
There's a lot of testimony.
Yeah, there is. And I think there's still some residual angst about the bill that I sponsored 2 years ago that was a larger attempt at shaping that process and doing that. So I think there's far more people paying attention when we start to put some different stipulations on how the ballot initiative process works. But I'm not getting a lot, Chris, and I don't think the ones I'm getting are specifically from our district. There's a few that I have received that people are concerned with the ability to get a ballot initiative passed, and it's on both sides of the political spectrum. There are people on the left and right that think that that is a way that they can get some changes made in government that the legislature is not doing. So my name is on this bill again as a supporter of it. I'll probably be speaking to it on the House floor. I do think it's a good idea. I do think that we are underrepresented, and I don't think it's too high of a hurdle. Nothing's changing other than the fact that we want to have the representation from every district in the state. So it's truly something that the whole state is interested in, not just some districts where there's a large population that can then outvote the other areas of the state. And that's my concern, is that it's a clean process and an equitable process, similar to how we make law in the legislature, because that is a lawmaking process. So as I said 2 years ago, these processes should reflect the lawmaking process that we go to make sure that everybody's voice is involved in that process.
So critics of the bill say that it would raise the bar so high that a citizen-based, a grassroots initiative would be practically impossible to pass. And they claim that, you know, a well-funded, you know, out-of-state interest would have the money to go to every single district in the state to get those 6% of votes. So what's your response on that?
I don't think it's going to be difficult to get those votes. It does set a little bit higher bar because we want everybody to be involved. They can't just ignore the rural areas of the state. I don't know, I'm trying to think of the right adjective there of how easy it is, or maybe it's an adverb, to collect signatures at this point, and meaning that $800,000 can get you as many signatures as you need within a matter of weeks, and you still have the 18 months to collect these signatures, and there are people that this is the business that they run across the whole United States, and they've been used by both sides. You know, if we go back to Medicaid expansion and then also the horse racing initiative that was on the ballot that same year, getting those dollars in, hiring people, they specifically target people, they go through voter rolls, and it's not hard to get those signatures these days. That's what's coming into the state already, and that's why it's very important to me that every area of the state is involved in making that decision, whether it goes on the ballot or not, because it's easy then also to put some dollars into the state to get a ballot initiative passed. We're fairly cheap compared to other states. I mean, they spend more money in Phoenix than they had to do in Idaho to get these things passed. So I am just trying to make it an equitable process in promoting this and doing that.
What would you think about making it since it is going to affect a constitutional right that people have in Idaho, what would you think about making it a constitutional question and putting it on the ballot to let the citizens vote on it?
On what the ballot initiative process looks like?
Yes, specifically the threshold for placing something on the ballot through an initiative.
Well, constitutionally, it's up to the legislature, and I think that's where it should be. I mean, I don't particularly. I prefer the referendum process, where the citizens can say we don't like the bill that you passed, than I do the initiative process. I think it's not deliberative, like making laws deliberative in this body. You get misinformation, and people can get stirred up, and depends on who has the most money to make those. The advertising and things like that. I mean, that's not solely it. We have passed other things in the past without that. But that's interesting, Chris. I don't know. I'd have to think about that. It seems a little contradictory, because a lot of the argument is that we shouldn't be doing it, or we're going beyond our scope of authority as the legislature. But it's clearly stipulated in the Constitution that it is our duty to set the parameters of the ballot initiative process. But that's an interesting concern. I mean, interesting thought. You know, last 2 years ago, it was, well, why don't we run a ballot initiative to say we're not going to have ballot initiatives anymore? So that's, you know, can kind of cut both ways with that.
Okay, well, let's move on to some other topics. You're on the House Transportation Committee, and the state's in an interesting position this year, where there's a big budget surplus due to some I guess fortuitous events, one being that Idaho's done a lot better through the pandemic than a lot of other states have in terms of our revenue collection. And also we saw a bunch of money come into the state because we started collecting tax on sales made over the internet.
Mm-hmm.
It's created the last number I saw was about $700 million surplus. What do you see that money doing for us with some of our transportation projects?
There was a bill that was started this morning, actually, that will be getting more dollars to transportation. It's going to increase a portion of the sales tax that goes into transportation for specific projects. It's called the TECM Fund, which is the Transportation Expansion and Congestion Mitigation Fund. Very wordy thing, but it needs to go directly to those projects that are for the congestion we're experiencing and the growth we're experiencing. So there will be a portion, I believe it's talking about roughly $250 million. It'll be a 60-40 split with the state and locals going forward in doing that. There will be, there's some little things around the edges. I think we passed something, and I'm sorry I say I think because this was a while ago and I'm trying to remember everything, that would now that was just a proposal. It was going to increase the title transfer fee, but that one went away. So this, I don't know the specifics of it. I know it's roughly about $250 million going into transportation to be split with the locals, and there's a couple other things. A lot of our discussion has been with some sort of tax reform again, and those things are a little bit coupled because of those extra dollars that are in the tax relief fund that have come in, and we have done very well compared to other states. I think we're one of the few states that actually has a surplus, let alone, I should say that is doing well, let alone has a surplus, because a lot of states are hurting. But the way the governor handled this and the way the state did it, a lot of people were able to come here and spend their dollars, and those extra federal dollars certainly helped going forward. But I think we're going to be seeing tax relief that's still being talked about. That's been one of the large topics as far as lowering income tax levels, lowering the corporate tax level, and then some sort of rebate to every taxpayer, whether that is a direct check or something to deal with property tax. We're still very concerned with property tax relief, but that's getting hung up in the Senate a little bit as well. So there will I should have more specifics on transportation dollars coming forward. We haven't really heard anything in transportation yet, and it generally will come out of JFAC first, and then we'll get to vote on it on the floor. So I know some things are on the perimeter of that, but not specifics. Speaking of transportation, though, I think it was in the paper on Sunday, but Senator Woodward and I had some meetings with ITD and the governor's office, and we're able to get the Lakeshore 95 intersection, to get some action on that starting this spring. So that was kind of a happy thing. This was a good time to bring a project like that forward, and the definitive need that we have because of those extra dollars. The board, ITD board, saw fit to make that one of their projects, and it's a two-year plan that will install some U-turns up by Bottle Bay Road so you can go right out of Lakeshore and safely get into a U-turn lane to go north, and then the same thing coming off of Bottle Bay, you'll be able to go right and get into a U-turn lane to go south and really help with the congestion that's being experienced there and a lot of the accidents that we're having. So that was a nice byproduct. It was just an easier conversation to have this year when we're somewhat flush with funds.
Yeah.
And doing that.
We spoke with Senator Woodward earlier, actually, and he did mention that that was going to move through. So that's some good news for our folks here.
It is.
Speaking of taxes, one that comes up just about every session is the tax on groceries and food.
Right.
Anything likely to change there? There are a lot of folks that say, you know, food, that's one thing that shouldn't be taxed. And we do, in fact, have a credit that taxpayers
Correct.
Get back. But do you see anything happening with that particular tax?
I don't. I think that's on the back burner again. And there's a lot of folks in the legislature that think that that is the only tax some people pay, because our tax strata there is so low that a lot of people don't even pay income tax. And so that's the only tax they pay, and that goes into the state and the functions of the state. I'm still in favor of removing it. And I was, an earlier proposal that we had in tax relief would have lowered the sales tax down to about 5.3. And that would we would have removed the credit, but it would have removed the total sales tax down to 5.3. And I thought that was a good way to go if we're not going to totally remove that sales tax, because then everything you're buying is less, and it helps everybody in that sense. But when we looked at some of the numbers, larger families would be paying more in removing that grocery tax credit that we have on our tax forms. And so it wasn't a true reduction for everybody, and that kind of waylaid that idea. And so I've heard nothing regarding anything coming forward to remove that sales tax on groceries at this point. There are folks in the legislature that have bills that purport to do that, but they're just not coming before the committee. So it's something we keep pushing on, and I do keep pushing on it, and they kind of chuckle at me and say, we're not doing that. But that's how the legislature works, unfortunately. Sometimes, you know, not all our great ideas don't get heard, or not everybody agrees with our great ideas when you bring everybody down here together. But it is something we'll keep taking a look at, I'm sure.
Well, it's amazing how fast 20 minutes go by. We're kind of running to the end of our time.
Oh, my goodness.
I did want to ask you, Representative Dixon, anything that's happening down there that you want your constituents to know about, possibly to weigh in on pending legislation?
Well, there's some things I've done for constituents, and you know, I like people to know that I am responsive, and I think most people do know that. There's a fund bill. There was a couple folks that contacted me in the fall that are interested in having reindeer ranches in Bonner County, and there's been a prohibition since the mid-90s on reindeer north of the Salmon River. So tracking that down, finding out if the Department of Ag had any issues or the Fish and Game, and nobody seemed to have any issues. So we have removed that prohibition, and these two gentlemen are excited to have the ability to start up a new business in Bonner County. And that's a fun one. And another one that I ran, and I have a hearing tomorrow also, has to do with a parallel path or an alternate path for families in crisis that may be heading into the foster care system with their children. But this will give folks the ability, or certain groups the ability, to have a roster of families that are willing to take children on short notice for an extended period of time. And Department of Health and Welfare.
That would let the parents decide what family Correct. Their kids might go to. I see.
Well, so it would be a program or an agency that has a roster of families, and it's completely parental driven. So it's before the state would need to get involved if there was homelessness or drug abuse or something like that would cause the crisis in that family. The family would choose to go to that agency. It's completely parental driven, and that was the nice thing when we had discussions with health and welfare. They said this isn't our jurisdiction because it's driven by the parent. There wasn't an action by the state yet or law enforcement at that point. And health and welfare is actually using one of those programs already in Sandpoint. They've sent a couple families to them. So we have it functioning. We're just putting that in code so that they can't change their mind later once people start building this infrastructure. There is a group in Sandpoint and then a group down here in Boise that are starting these, and they're associated with a program called Safe Families for Children that is across the U.S. and in Canada and Great Britain as well. So it's a well-vetted program. And that'll be helpful to help relieve some of the pressure upon the foster care system. We don't have enough families to help. And also, it helps keep families together before that foster care system starts, which is hard to get back out of usually.
Mm-hmm. Well, Reindeer Ranches.
That's a fun one. I just like mentioning
it. Well, I just have curiosity. Where did the prohibition come from, you know, for the northern part of the state?
So it was the caribou herd that was up there in the Selkirks above Priest Lake, and the concerns of domesticated caribou, which are what reindeer are considered, and then wild caribou, and the same issues that you have with elk. But they would still have to go through the whole permitting process with the Department of Ag. We're just removing that prohibition so they can start that process.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Representative Dixon, thanks so much for speaking with us, and carry on down there. I know there's a ton of other issues going on that we didn't have a chance to touch on, but I tell you what, we may not get to you if the session's going to end in early to mid-April again before it ends, but we'll definitely want to circle back when you get back up here.
Yep, I'd love to, Chris. I always appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. Thank you.
That's it for our show today. If you've just tuned in, you've been listening to Community Conversations on 88.5 KRFY and our talks with 1st District Legislators Senator Jim Woodward and Representative Sage Dixon. I'm Chris Bessler. Be sure to tune in each Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. for more Community Conversations. If you happen to miss all or part of a show, remember you can hear the recorded podcast on our website at www.krfy.org and click to our podcast page. Thanks for listening today.